Good afternoon and welcome to Ethics Talk. This afternoon we'll be having an informal or colloquial conversation about food, campus grow, and food-related issues. Ethics Talk would like to thank special guest host Josh Johnson. Would you like to say hi, Josh?
Hello.
Okay. He's our campus grow rep. I don't know.
Yeah.
We may or may not have some backup coming for you, but
yeah.
For now, this is what we have. So, we want to talk about food, and I think probably the most interesting point in our preliminary conversation was on the disparity of food costs between the United States and other countries. Mm-hmm. What can you tell me about that, Josh?
Well, looking here, the cost of eating global and for the United States of America, the percent of total income spent on food has steadily decreased this century in the United States, and it says here a fact from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, over 20% before 1930 was spent on food.
Of total income?
Of total income.
Okay.
And now it's near 5%. And I guess kind of getting to the heart of that, kind of going off on a tangent and looking at, I guess, consumers as a whole, you have like this whole population who has kind of been separated from their food in the fact that if you go into a McDonald's, for instance, you find that the workers there are basically operating things with machines telling them what to do. The food is frozen or pre-prepped in some way before it's sent there. It's generally shipped sometimes up to thousands of miles from where it actually came from.
But very low skill levels, you're saying?
Very low skill levels, and that's the idea, is like kind of a revolving door effect where you have workers who can come in with very little training, very little knowledge of even how the operation works, and perform their task day in and day out for a very low rate of pay. But anyways, kind of getting away from that, seeing how you go into a fast food restaurant, instead of preparing like food at your house or even picking your own food, you have this separation from the environment, and it's kind of driven consumers to be really materialistic in that they spend more of their income on, for instance, an iPod or a cheap piece of furniture instead of spending it on something like food, because food has been kind of lessened, I guess, in terms of its importance amongst humans.
Let me roll it back here. So you're actually saying that this decrease from 20% total income around post-depression era, mm-hmm, to now 5% total income spent by families on food, you're, mm-hmm, saying that this decrease in the cost of food is actually bad?
Yes.
That's interesting. See, so my first reaction would be to think, well,
it's going up, so, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Sun is shining, perhaps?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Well, it's hidden costs. You go into a market and you buy something organic and you hear comments from people like, oh, my God, it's ridiculous. But what they're not realizing is when you're paying for your McDonald's or what have you, a lot of that food is derived from subsidized crops such as corn, wheat, or soy, which are the three largest subsidized crops in the United States,
and
probably the world. Subsidies are basically tax dollars going to pay farmers to grow a certain crop. So instead of growing, strawberries, for instance, the government comes along and says, hey, if you grow corn, we'll give you money, like, $130 per bushel, for example.
So the government is literally paying farmers to grow one of these three crops.
Yes, yeah,
okay.
Exactly. Kind of getting into more, I guess, lengthy description of how the subsidies work. I noticed the other day, for instance, that bridge cards are now accepted at some fast food joints. Which
I can't believe that. It's
really ridiculous.
It seems
completely
counterintuitive.
And can you just explain what a bridge card is? Because not everybody knows.
Is basically food stamps. That's also basically your tax dollars going to pay for people who don't make enough income. Usually, I believe it's $20,000 or less, which is, I think, $20,000 is the poverty line. So you have people going in and their tax dollars are paying for the food, which is mostly based from corn. And we can get into details on that later, I suppose.
Sure.
But then you also have the card that you're paying for the food with, which you also helped put money into if you do have a job, because such as myself, I do work. I graduated, but I need a bridge card to pay for my food because I make about half of what the poverty line is considered, and most of my income goes towards food.
Okay.
So,
just to be perfectly clear, there's two different state entities at work here. One of them is the state of Michigan, which, mm-hmm, runs—I forget the exact name of the program. Anybody bail me out on this one? Hopefully somebody will call in. Bridge I know my card. Girlfriend's thinking on the phone, like, oh, how could you forget? Starts with an F, something about, like, food dispersal or something
yeah.
like that. Regardless, it's a state program. The Bridge Card, as Josh pointed out, is a lot like food stamps. Based on income as well as many other factors, people sort of go in, meet a caseworker, and it's determined whether or not they are, quote, in need. And if they're determined to be in need, then the state has this program that literally gives them food on a magnetic sort of credit mm-hmm. card each month
basically.
That can only be used for food. Now, what Josh has just pointed out to us is that this is now accepted at fast food restaurants. I don't know which. Do you know which ones?
Didn't really want to say because okay. thought it might be more like advertising, free right. advertising for them.
So unnamed restaurants, yeah. which we won't mention now except the Bridge Card, which I think is absolutely ridiculous. I can't tell you how raged I am, but we'll get into that later. So that's the state actor. That's the government spending at a state level. And Josh is saying that our tax dollars are essentially paying for this, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm. Can I interrupt for a second
yes.
before you go to federal?
Yes.
I assume you're going to federal
okay.
soon. But this is not state. This is global. And this is Article 25 from the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And I figured I'd just throw it out now in the beginning of the show because what Michigan is doing insofar as they are basically using the tax dollars of other Michigan citizens to help Michigan citizens in need eat is following, arguably, one provision of this Article 25. If you don't know anything about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, it was signed by various members of the UN General Assembly in 1948, but it says, everyone has the right to a standard of living adequate for the health and well-being of himself and of his family, including food. So bridge cards can be understood as actually being consistent with this provision of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
Sure.
Period.
Thank you for that interjection. And actually, it was quite fortuitous because while you were going on that, I won't call it a tangent because it was very much related. I remember the name of the state program. It's the FAP, Food Assistance Program, just came to me. I didn't get a text, I promise. I remembered it all on my own. Okay, so that's how the state functions. Now, the other part of, I guess, the paradox that Josh is describing is that the government has what he's calling subsidies. I don't know if there's a technical name for the program. I mean, if there's some...
I don't know the technical name. I've just always heard them described as subsidies.
Okay,
food
so literally
subsidies.
Subsidized farming.
Yeah.
The government
mm-hmm.
is paying people to grow specific crops.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know if you can answer this question, but the first question that comes to mind for me is why these crops? And what's so special about soy, corn, et cetera? Why not, as you said, strawberries? I mean, I love strawberries. What's wrong with strawberries?
They're very, I guess, difficult to raise and also pick. They are the second largest cash crop in the United States. However, I guess the real benefit from growing corn is that it can be made into, I think, around 180 different products.
Sure. And we're making, like, oil, glue, everything.
Yeah. Okay. So you can make, for instance, plastics out of it. You can make, if you turn around a box of any ready-to-go meal in your cupboard at home, you'll probably find at least five ingredients derived from corn. Some of them go along the names of dextrose, maltodextrin, for instance. You'll find corn in batteries, for instance. You'll find corn being fed to the very cattle that are being used for the meat in your McDonald's hamburger, for instance. And, perhaps a lot of people will think about, you know, why would you feed corn to cattle? Because if you look at cattle from an evolutionary standpoint, you realize that, well, don't they usually graze?
Right.
On grass.
Yeah.
Well, if you do some reading, you'll find out, I think it's around 180 days they can live on corn and they just kill over because their bodies have not evolved to digest corn. So when you hear about the E. coli outbreaks in the food system, what's happening is that their bodies are not able to handle the corn digestion and the E. coli start multiplying at a rapid rate. And then when that cattle is slaughtered, you have all this excess E. coli that can leak in, especially because of the slaughterhouse practices, which are very, very dirty, because you have mostly migrant workers who are doing that. I say migrant workers, but I really mean, I guess, immigrants, illegal immigrants, who were, believe it or not, put out of work by the cheap subsidized corn because we can produce corn and sell it to the Mexican corn farmers cheaper than they can grow it. And then we have companies like IBP, who's the largest, I believe the largest meat packer in the world. Mm-hmm. They have shuttles that literally drive into Mexico City. They have billboards. They have radio ads. and they say, hey, come work for IBP, and they literally bus up the illegal immigrants into the United States, and you hear congressmen complaining about our immigration problem in the United States. Well, it's because you have lobbyists for these large meatpacking companies, you know, padding the wallets, I guess, of these congressmen, and they just pretend like they care about it on television, of course, but really they don't care about it. They want the illegal immigrants to be coming in.
You're asking like why these three subsidized. I think it's a really good question, and I think it has a lot more to do than just nutrient content. It's like who's profiting by these things being subsidized.
Sounds like a vicious cycle.
Definitely does.
Mm-hmm. Here first, corn, main source of all the U.S.'s economical problems. The voice you're hearing now is Chris Venegas, who is also a student here and a member of Ethics Talk. And also, are you the president of Campus Girl?
We are actually horizontally led, so there's no president.
Okay.
I was a co-coordinator. And
I'm glad I didn't jump on that. Last time I asked that question, I got slammed. So talk to me here, Chris. What's happening?
Well, I'm sorry I had to join you a little late there.
No, it's okay. Don't worry about it.
I think what's really cool to talk about with the subsidies is the fact that we are able to sell these crops at like a really low price as export goods. So when we go into Mexico, now with NAFTA, we don't have to pay like big tariffs on trade.
Right.
And we just sell this corn to people that were otherwise subsistence farmers. They have been for generations, like tens of generations, like these ancient farmers in rural areas. And they no longer can afford to really grow their own corn because they can't sell it on the market. So they can't make a little bit of money on the side, you know, like with their crop.
So the price of corn has dropped?
The price of corn has dropped dramatically.
Okay.
Right, and so then these farmers have like choices to make. They can either be like part of the system and like sell their property to like a large agricultural producer, like some global like company, and then produce for them. But then like they don't get to raise their like diverse array of crops, and they have to use these like GMOs that they're like sort of prescribed. So it's like a complete loss of their culture. They stop being able to grow what they want. They either lose their farm because they can't afford to keep it up or because they sell out. And eventually they might not even be able to work on their own property anymore.
So again, this is another detrimental effect of the decrease in the cost of food.
Right.
Okay.
Can I chime in for a second there?
Absolutely.
About the GMOs, the genetically modified organisms that Chris is mentioning.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah. Another thing about that is these farmers, for instance, who have had farming in their family for generations. Now you have this influx of GMOs in their culture, and we don't have any idea what GMOs do on a cellular level, on an agricultural level, on a biological level, because the FDA doesn't test these.
Right.
It's actually the EPA's job to do that. For instance, you have BT corn, which develops its own bacteriological toxin, hence the letters BT, the acronym. And they don't know what it does to your body because it's not a crop anymore. It's actually a pesticide. It's corn that's classified as a pesticide because it creates its own pesticide.
So it's no longer regulated by the FDA, which regulates food. It's regulated by the EPA, which regulates pesticides. It's actually most GMO grains are used as feed or like for sugar or for like
high fructose corn syrup.
Right.
Being one of the big ones.
Is made from BT corn?
Most likely, probably. Yeah. I mean, there's really no way to track it. There's so much corn produced now that you can't even track crops of corn. There's literally 33% of the United States is corn. The land is used to grow corn. So imagine trying to track all of that corn. It'd be impossible.
Right. So we can kind of shift gears here and talk about, like, how these crops are actually being grown, like, physically in the fields. Like, there's not that much conclusive evidence about what GMOs are doing to our physical health, but they do promote certain methods of farming. And the one major one that a lot of people have heard of that is detrimental is monoculture farming. And all that means is mono is one culture, so it's you grow one crop in an enormous field. And what this ends up causing is, like, a sort of new ecology in the field, if you will. Because there's only one crop, there's not really any die down. The crop is harvested. So every year, you just take from the soil. Nothing like really decays and gets back in the soil. So what that does 3 or 4 years down the road is completely strip the nutrients from the soil you're working with, and then you have to fertilize.
Right. Well, this is why we use crop rotation, right?
Right. And this
or
is
don't, as it happens.
This is what happens when you don't rotate crops, yeah.
Okay.
And so this is clearly, I mean, it sounds like, oh, man, this could be tough to farm now. We don't have any nutrients in our soil. But there are all these chemical fertilizers that you can apply, and they're being sold at like pretty large rates to these monoculture farmers that are being paid subsidies to grow food. So these chemicals come into the field, and they're not completely like saturating in the soil because it's not like a organic form of the chemical. It's just like ammonia, like NH4. Is like sprayed on the crop field, and then some of it leaches in and is caught up by the clay layers, and some of the different soil layers will like catch some of this ammonia. But other things like ammonia and nitrogen and potassium will completely leach through like all the soil layers and get into the groundwater. And then this starts to cause problems in like aquatic ecosystems.
I assume in drinking water.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there have been some studies about that, but again, it's like questionable research.
Gotcha. How can you really
indefinite
know
sure. Right, but okay. The things that we do definitely see are these things called algal blooms. The okay. most notable would be in the Gulf of Mexico, where you clearly have the Mississippi depositing all of its like runoff into the Gulf there, and there's like the breadbasket of the United States is abutting the Mississippi River, and all these tributaries like gather up these agrochemicals. And it sounds like harmful harmless because it's a natural like nutrient, it should be used by plants. But when it's not, it goes into the water and it feeds these oxygen-consuming bacteria and algae.
Which actually starved the fish, right, of oxygen?
Right. And okay. What happens is that these algae and bacteria usually don't have enough nitrogen or potassium to really grow a lot. So their population is regulated, and it has sort of been stayed the same way for thousands of years. And all of a sudden, these algae no longer have a limiting nutrient. A limiting nutrient is the one nutrient that stops an organism from overproducing. So now there's no limitation on nutrients, and they're able to suck up all the oxygen as well as the extra nitrogen and potassium, and then they end up clouding out like a whole bay or a pond in smaller scales. They boost like their population to like the absolute max, and then all die out. And the second they die out, there's no more like life in this area, as like again in the Gulf of Mexico it happened. So there's no oxygen there, and there's also no longer plant matter, so it takes years to recover from such like a toxification of a system like that.
It sounds similar, tell me if I'm wrong, to what happened to Lake Erie with all the phosphates. Algal bloom, starved the oxygen, fish all died, dead
yep,
lake
exactly.
Basically. Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And just kind of noting, these are some of the hidden costs I was mentioning earlier. Mm-hmm. You know,
gotcha.
You think regular food is cheap, but if you look at all the costs associated with it, such as the environmental, not to mention the health costs to us humans.
So the 15% drop, you're saying, of the cost of food post-depression to now has been made up for in other seriously detrimental ways. Is that
yeah.
the main point here?
Yeah, a lot of people will say, you know, like, these are kind of like hot words, like our generations that come after us will be paying for our flaws.
Sure. Yep.
So.
Mm-hmm. You're telling me that that's been happening for 70 years, basically?
At least the buildup has.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So, again, I guess you already answered this question, but I'm just not understanding. So why is the government giving these subsidies? I mean, do we have to get into a discussion about politics to really understand this?
You really would, and anything I say about the political stressors on the decision makers would be mostly hearsay or mm-hmm. presumptive. I really don't know the facts behind who's paying for what.
Okay, but I take it money is an important factor
yeah.
here.
Mm-hmm.
As Dr. Epstein would say, show me the money, right? Okay. I'll let you take it from me. Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, yeah, it seems like there's all this, you know, serious, like, problems that you're mentioning, and you wonder, like, what sort of conscious person would be engaging in these activities knowingly, doing it with the evidence that's out there of what the detrimental mm-hmm. costs are. You know, and I know you say you'd be presuming what would be going on, and I guess, you know, it just seems like money is the only thing that like really shines out to me. I mean, mm-hmm. Other than that, like what other reasons? Cause, I mean, do you have any other reasons besides money? It just, I don't know that money would be enough motivator for me to do that, you know, or mm-hmm. most of the people that I know. And so I'm trying to think like,
right.
What other reason?
Well, you know, in a capitalist system, like the consumer is supposed to be able to make a conscious decision about
right.
what they're buying. That's how the market's regulated. Like if a product is bad, people will know about it and they won't spend the money like you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
No. So it's like that separation I had mentioned earlier of humans from their environment. Mm-hmm. And like when you have the people making the loads of cash off of this, they're sitting in some business office in New York City they never see the fields that they're making profits mm-hmm. off of. They never have to see the sick people. I mean, maybe they see the people on the streets who are impoverished and, you know, sleeping in a cardboard box. But their decisions, they don't have to actually directly witness what their decisions are doing to people.
And that right. goes for the consumer as well.
So
yeah. And on that same point, you know, I think Josh is making a really good point about the hidden costs, how people don't see the return on their actions.
Mm-hmm.
At each individual level, you know, we're talking about the system as a whole, but if we sort of hone in and talk about each individual level, like the farmer himself, for example, can you really fault the farmer for, let's say, trying a new fertilizer because he's barely making ends meet? Or can you blame the farmer who would really prefer to grow peas or strawberries, but who can only make money by receiving a government subsidy for soy? You know, it's really hard to look at one person in the system and say, wow, you're the bad guy. You're doing mm-hmm. this. It's really the system as a whole, I think.
And it's right. also hard to feel like you have any sort of impact as an individual consumer. You're like, well, me buying this box of ramen noodles one time isn't going to, like, completely topple the organic food industry. So you don't really have, like, a direct connection, again, to the consequences of your purchasing choices.
And another thing about, like, going back to the GMO thing, is that a lot of farmers actually kind of get wrangled into having to grow GMOs and right. subsidized crops because Monsanto has, you know, when they've modified an organism, you can now patent life. So when they modify a seed, for instance, the Terminator gene, which, as many people I hope know, if you grow a plant, it usually produces seed for you to use next year. Well, that no longer happens with these genetically engineered organisms. Instead, the seeds never occur. There's no seeding that ever occurs in the plant. You grow it one season, it dies, and then you have to buy the seeds from Monsanto again. And, you know, if you look at Monsanto's history, it's a chemical company. What is it doing dealing in seeds? Well, it's so that they can make money selling the seeds and make money off the pesticides and fertilizers that they're selling to the farmers. And if you have, like, the GMO, if you have seeds saved, they actually have a team of 70 investigators that drive around at early hours in the morning. They go into fields illegally. They are going on somebody's private property. They grab the seeds, and they can tell by the DNA if it is their seed, and if it is, you have a lawsuit coming at you that can cost millions of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
So they contractually make you obligate the rest of your life to growing for them. And if you're looking at like a grid of 9 squares, if you're the farmer in the center who's growing organic and you get contamination from wind or like a bird flies over and drops a Monsanto seed, they come in, they say, hey, guess what? You just broke the law. We're going to sue the life out of you unless you start growing genetically engineered seeds from our company.
Straight copyright infringement.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Who exactly is Monsanto? You know, this third-party evil person we're talking about?
They're responsible, along with Dow, for developing such wonderful things as dioxin, which is basically Agent Orange was dioxin,
mm-hmm.
and napalm during Vietnam. So
yeah.
Just one of the large chemical corporations.
And now they're genetically engineering the food we eat.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Oh, okay. Which is then subsidized by your tax dollars.
All right,
it's a vicious system.
You talked me right into it.
So when, just imagine you're the one person that's trying to resist these subsidized right. crops, and you're trying to grow, like, even not organically, just like your own open pollinated, which means like your seed is produced. If it's open pollinated, it produces seed the next year. So you're trying to grow an open pollinated crop, and everyone around you is growing the GMOs that are being subsidized. The cost of your labor and your seeds and all your work now is way more that than the market price of what you're going to be able to sell it for.
So this really answers two questions. One, mm-hmm. why is organic food so much more expensive? And two, what are we losing from non-organic food? Why is the price so much lower? So
right.
really filled in the blanks for me. But you keep telling me, what is one person going to do about it? So now I'm wondering, what can I do about it?
Well, you know, knowing the facts is the very first thing. I mean, I always try to preach essentially that you should be asking where everything came from that you have. I mean, Hope, I know you talk a lot about precious minerals recently, about the things that are the constituent parts of our cell phones, and like it's hard to know where your precious minerals are coming from and what kind of mining is impacting what kind of community where. I mean, these questions are good to ask if you really want to be a supporter of capitalism and say, I think that my capital choices are going to make a difference, I'm going to vote with my money. You have to know what your money's buying.
Okay. So education, which hopefully we're doing right now.
Right? Yeah, hope at least so. Exposing. And we do have some site resources on ethicstalk.cmish.edu if you want to do your own investigation.
Okay.
There's a lot of good places to do research about global food, like the UN FAO, the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations. They do a lot of statistical gathering of, you know, numbers and census reports of farmers and their wages and all that sort of thing.
Okay, again, the show resources site is ethicstalk.cmish.edu. Click on show resources and you'll see some of the links Chris is talking about. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Ethics Talk. We have a few guests from Campus Grow currently talk about problems in the global food industry, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Right now we're talking about the U.S. specifically, but who knows? We might expand.
Sure.
So, Chris, you're telling me the first step is to educate myself.
Right.
Okay, so I'm educated. I'm really not, but let's pretend I am. Mm-hmm. We're taking a thought experiment here.
Right.
Let's pretend I'm educated. What do I do now? I mean, I can choose not to purchase foods that I think have been grown with Monsanto seeds. Did I pronounce that right?
I think it's Monsanto.
Monsanto. Okay, I can choose to buy only organic, mm-hmm. something like this. But really, what kind of impact is that going to make? I mean,
yeah, it really is a tough thing to quantify, like how your choices are going to make an impact. But one way that I started to believe that I could have a positive impact is by getting to know the person that actually grew the food. So it's like, well, if I at least go and make sure that one person I know is doing it right, then I can go and buy all my food for a year, or at least for the season, from this farmer. And this is really well promoted through community-supported agricultures. It's abbreviated CSA. And Josh, want to tell them what a CSA is?
Basically, it's a farmer offering up their goods during the growing season, mainly the summer. Mm-hmm. And it's a set cost. Usually, I think it's been going up. But for around like $350, $400, you can usually get a variety of vegetables every week delivered to a location, or sometimes you have to go to the actual farm and pick it up weekly. But they basically provide you with food for the entire summer. Mm-hmm. And like for me, I think it'd actually be too much for me to eat mm-hmm. in a week in some cases. But
it's usually meant for like a four-person household.
Yeah, it's made for a household. So it's a way to support a local farmer mm-hmm. and at the same time get an array of vegetables to feed the family.
Right. So here you're avoiding those harmful things you're talking about, Mike, and you're also able to provide a farmer with a steady source of income, because what you're doing when you agree to buy a share of this farm is you're saying, listen, I understand that we might not have a really good growing season for tomatoes, we might not have a good growing season for garlic, but what I'm willing to do is invest in you this like flat rate of money so that you know you're going to be able to do this and not go like belly under because you weren't able to produce your number one cash crop. And maybe if you do that and you next year you're looking at trying to produce that same thing, you're going to say, well, no, I'm going to switch my farming practices and use these fertilizers and these drought resistant genetically modified seeds so that I don't end up going belly up next year.
Interesting. Okay, and without, you know, advertising, without putting my stamp mm-hmm. of approval on anything, what kind of costs are we talking about? You said on a per weekly basis, or do we pay up?
It's usually like mm-hmm. an upfront, like $400, $450 fee, and you get vegetables for what is it, like 3 months?
No, it's quite a bit longer.
Than that?
Yeah, around six to seven months.
Okay, wow.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, there's
actually quite a few springing up in the Mount Pleasant area. Mm-hmm. One is the Spear Family Farm. They do a CSA. They've been doing it for a long time, and I'm pretty sure they have all the customers they can handle at this point. I mean, they're really a popular thing. They started, you know, West Coast and East Coast. And you see, even in Vermont, which has got colder winters than we do here, they have year-round CSAs because they've been so successful. People are doing greenhouse growing and able to eat locally, like, year-round. But, yeah, just, I mean, you can Google community-supported agriculture, 48858, and see what comes up.
Yeah, I was going to say, I noticed there's probably about three or four other, maybe more CSAs mm-hmm. that popped up just this year.
Really?
They haven't really had any competition, the Swear Family Farm, and now they have, I'd say, at least four other farms
mm-hmm.
Doing CSAs. So.
And if that's too much, that's a big commitment. You can always just try to start small and go check out. I mean, even like Glenn's or something might have some local produce, or Meijer might have some local produce, and there's a store downtown, a grocery store, that consistently carries local during the season, Green Tree Cooperative Grocery.
Sure. I'm not sure about this, so don't quote me on this, but I do think I've seen at different grocery stores stamps that say something to the effect of locally grown or something.
Yeah,
like
I think I've seen that too, a lot, yeah.
You do have to be careful, though. I know that, like, locally grown products at Meijer, for instance, are probably still most likely GMO potatoes and the like, and a lot of the producers in the state actually provide to Lay's, I believe. feet away. So
yeah, I've seen the commercials.
I'm going to be guessing that they're not using open pollinated variety of potatoes. But
yeah, and if you're not convinced that open pollinated is great too, there is, since you mentioned global, I'll use this global example. There is a some evidence that GMOs are helpful in the Philippines in a study that when they went into new farms and asked them to grow genetically modified rice or cotton, they witnessed larger profit margin because they could employ less farmers to go out and do weeding. They can employ less farmers to go out and do watering because these seeds are drought resistant. They pick up like drought resistant strains and engineer these crops to be able to outcompete like a natural crop version, I guess. And a lot of times it is BT. It for most examples, it is a BT crop that is being utilized. And what a BT crop does is produce its own pesticide, as we mentioned before. And when this does this, in any sort of ecology where a crop or a plant is killing the pests near it, those pests obviously won't have offspring. But the pests that will have offspring are those that are resistant. So the first year, maybe only 5% of those pests are able to eat the crop instead of 100%. So you're like, oh, wow, we have a better crop yield. I'm utilizing less labor. And then next year, only those 5% that have bred the year before that, now there's 15% of the pests are this resistant strain. And a pest could be a fungus, a pest could be an insect, a pest could be a plant.
And are we actually, I'm just going to go ahead and throw this name label on them, are we actually seeing super pests or like these toxin-resistant pests?
Yeah, there's a good example of, it's called, I think it's mare's tail. It's just some sort of weed that was eventually able to develop a resistance just because, I mean, saying develop a resistance is kind of misleading. It's like a plant like learned how to resist this.
Right.
But that's not what happened. What happened is that all the plants that couldn't resist it died.
Right.
There was no more competition. The plant that could resist it just overbred. And in 5 years' time, it's the only pest you have in the field, and you have to switch your pesticide.
Gotcha. And this is similar to the sort of thing we talk about with like hospital superviruses, right?
Shine some light on that. I don't know.
Well, yeah, I know there's like extremely resistant forms of Streptococcus. You know, there's Staphylococcus. I believe that's. Don't quote me on this. I don't have the source in front of me. I'm sure you know. Dr. Wygant is like listening. He's going to call in and bash me for this. But I think that the resistant strains of Staph are currently the number one cause of death in hospitals. I could be wrong about that, but people who are in hospitals for other things end up getting this super like sort of retrovirus and die. Because it's resistant to all of our penicillin, all of our amoxicillin.
Right, so it's the antibiotic resistance.
Exactly,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely the exact same sort of natural system of selection.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you're telling me the solution to kind of switch gears, the solution, if you're listening and thinking, what can I do to stop this vicious cycle, buy locally from farmers that you know are doing the right thing.
Right.
Something
and,
like that?
Or I would take it a step further and enjoy growing your own food. I mean, it is a great way to exercise, get outside in fresh air, save some money at the same time, and you end up doing things, you know, hopefully in a more healthy way for the environment. You utilize a backyard that would otherwise just be getting mowed. So, I mean, there's a lot of options when you start to really be concerned with this. And that kind of brings up the ethics of, like, food choices. I mean, if you've been with us for the whole show, maybe you've heard about how GMOs hurt farmers or how export-import markets, depending on what they are, can hurt the local citizens of a new field or a new farm. What should you do? I mean, maybe you're not motivated to do anything, and this is kind of an ethical issue.
Which I would say that's the majority of people. They'll hear this, and they'll go, oh, and then they'll be like, that's terrible, and they'll go on doing the same thing they've always been doing. Frankly, that's what I see happening. And I think, you know, people look at it and they'll be like, well, I'm going to buy what's the lowest cost because I'm a broke joke, you know. And
unfortunately, I'm kind of in that boat.
Yeah, I'm kind of in that boat too, you know. And I find myself definitely buying things, you know, that are probably bad for me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just like, oh, yeah, 99 cents for a box of macaroni.
Yes.
Actually, I think it's 48 cents.
I mean, not to go off on a huge tangent here, but I think that's kind of the point of the system is – You know, you get sick from the poor quality food, then you have to buy pharmaceuticals that are made from petrochemicals, just like the fertilizers that were sprayed on it.
This is sounding way too endemic the more we talk about it.
Yeah. So, but,
I mean, you could treat the symptoms or you can treat the cause and eat healthy.
Is there anything we can do on a macro scale? Is there anything that can be done across the board?
Well, it depends how much you believe in the democratic system as is.
Tell me more.
Well, recently, Josh and I have been a bit disenfranchised by a couple of things going on in the Michigan legislature. Quite a few unconstitutional proposals have actually been passed, like House Bill 4214. This is a tangent.
No, it's good.
Google House Bill 4214. It's the Emergency Financial Manager Bill, which allows...
It was on the front cover of CM Life a couple weeks ago.
Right, there's been some coverage already. It just it essentially allows Governor Snyder to, along with his financial team, declare any sort of municipality bankrupt. And when they do that, they completely wipe out all elected officials. They're fired, they lose their pensions, they lose health care. And in their stead is placed an emergency financial manager who makes $250,000, $250,000 salary, which is I was trying to look at the zeros in my mind, and I was just...
Well, you know, I understand. You're basically talking about financial martial law, I think is the term people are using.
Mm-hmm.
In my hometown, I won't say where I'm from, that actually doesn't sound like such a bad idea. It's pretty nasty hometown politics. But anyway, tell me more.
Well, you're asking about the macro scale, and I would usually be, you know, all in love with democracy and say, go talk to your congressman or representative, but maybe that's not a good option right now. Maybe you have to get out and just talk to your friends and say, we need to make some choices together to do something better.
Can I just follow up on that point and also connect it to the point that Nick made about, well, and I think, Mike, you're also echoing this point, that the average person is going to hear this and go, well, I can't really do anything. And I just want to say that I totally agree with that, that the average person may intellectually say, you know, this is messed up and it's bad, but I can't really do anything about it. And I agree that that is the common response to not just food ethics, but any sort of issue that someone says, oh, that's messed up. Very few people actually act, and I think that contributes to what you're complaining about, Chris, about this disenchantment with democracy. Because in the end, if you're really going to have it work correctly, you have to have people act and be committed through thick and thin. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people think, oh, the democratic process, all I have to do is go to the voting booth on election day and I'm participating, but truly that's not. So I just wanted to make that point. I think these points are connected. Mm-hmm. This infrequency of action that we see, and the fact that you're disenchanted with the democratic process, they're two pieces of the same pie, I would say.
Yes, absolutely.
Just to bring up another point, a second kind of, I don't know, follow up, I guess. John Locke, in his second treatise on civil government, who informed like the writers of the Constitution, also said basically the main job of the citizens is not even to go to the voting booths and vote, but to actually be a watchdog, basically, for the government to ensure that they're doing what is best for the commonwealth, is what he called it.
Yeah, one of the four pillars of democracy is civil action. Like, the people are supposed to rise up and be a monitor of the system.
And it's really hard, though, because we're so disconnected from each other in this society. It doesn't seem that we have a connected ideology that, you know, as you mentioned earlier when I was like, it can't just be money that's the driving the rationale behind these evildoers. And what we kind of came up was that there is a rationale that's going around that allows them to justify the sorts of actions that we're doing. And one of them, namely, you know, is just being like, I don't have that much money, you know, and I have a bunch of other stuff on my plate that I need to be doing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm going to focus in on this small thing that I'm going to do. And, you know, it's, you know, worth it to me, whatever. And I guess the point I'm just trying to make is this disconnection that we have from each other. And we don't have any place, I guess, to come and meet and to really do anything as a collective. And without the collective, we have nothing.
I think that's the point.
Here's an idea. I just heard of this really cool organization at CMU. They're called Campus Grow. And they go hang out in the garden and grow organic vegetables and learn how to sprout seeds. And they fail flat on their faces and learn from it. And they come back next year fighting strong and get huge carrots to munch on all winter long.
Awesome.
How do I join?
Well, there's always the Facebook method, but we meet Wednesday nights 5:30 in the Down Under food court. And once this dang snow goes away, we'll be in the garden most evenings.
Mm-hmm. I just want to say how ironic that, you know, Nick, you're saying that we don't really have a common place to meet when, hello, Facebook. I mean, it's, you know, if you look at what's happening in North Africa, for instance, there you have a totally different use of Facebook, right? Because without Facebook, those revolutions would not have happened.
Which is just crazy to think about. Let's just stop.
That is how people are using it. And it's like, and over here, we don't seem to be using it to the same extent for political purposes, maybe in a superficial sense. But I just want to say that it's bizarre to hear you say that, because everybody says your generation is so connected and so wired.
I guess by commonplace was the wrong kind of thing to use, the wrong term to use. I guess common ideology and common thing to go against, a common thing to say, I truly believe in this and I truly want to do something for it, against it, whatever. And that's where our disconnect is not so much in a commonplace, because yes, we all have Facebook and, you know, we all have a place where we can engage, you know, and some people do use it, I guess, virtuously. Mm-hmm. But on the whole, there's no connection in saying, okay, listen, this is definitely a problem we all agree with. Let's all do something about it.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Because nobody agrees on what's all the problem. And even this food thing that's being brought up, or I shouldn't say food thing, the food ethics we've been talking about, you know, there's definitely people that would argue against, you know, definitely some points that are being made, I'm sure of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there'd be lack of agreement on whether or not, you know, what you're sort of pushing is, you know, against capitalist principles, and that capitalists, you know, I'm sure there's some capitalists who would really find issue with some of the things that are being discussed.
Well, I'll just jump all over that one. First of all, I think a subsidy in general is against capitalism, but that's not the point. What I just wanted to say, it's sort of, I guess, to provide you with some ammunition, Nick.
Thank you.
Is remembering, remembering my eighth grade history lesson, subsidies were originally a very good thing. Because what was happening, imagine that, right around the 1930s, is that farmers weren't making any money. In fact, many farmers couldn't farm anymore, and produce stopped being produced. To counteract this, the government began paying farmers, which was a very good thing at that time, to grow food. And here we have the subsidy. Now, the problem is, like with any other governmental organization, you give it time and a budget and let it run away, next thing you know, you have a problem on your hands.
Yep.
But yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Nick, that you might have people who would say, well, why is a subsidy a bad thing? Well, because it perpetuates this vicious cycle.
I just want to say, sorry, it's not so much on subsidies, but this point that there's no thing that we can all agree is bad and there will be disagreement. Since you brought up John Locke, you know, I've got to bring up the ancient Greeks, and in particular Plato and the dialogue. The Euthyphro says, we all agree that the unjust man should be punished. So we can agree on these general claims that certain things are bad.
Mm-hmm.
What we disagree about is who the unjust man is, what he did, and when. So we disagree on the very specifics and particulars. I think everybody agrees that democracy is a good thing, but we disagree on the means by which it should be brought about and so forth. And I think we really lose the forest for the trees, or the trees for the forest, whatever the hell that phrase is. That when we talk about disagreement and so forth, that we lose sight of the fact that, you know, there's this background, or there are certain things that we do agree on. And when you really come up to the real disagreement is when you're actually acting, and you see that, okay, in order for me to execute this next thing, I have to assume that this means that. And people don't get far enough in the debate, if you will, to know that the disagreement, the meaningful disagreement, surrounds real action and activity surrounding the solution of the problem that everybody agrees is a problem.
And a lot of times it takes, like, a complete life cycle of the problem. And by that, I mean the problem has to manifest in some cataclysmic event in which many people are affected. And maybe that will inspire, like, okay, now this is obviously an issue. We can, like, clarify what the issue is. And then people are inspired to act when there's, God forbid, loss of life or other negative consequence.
I'm not going to, like, get all political or anything.
It's too late.
I guess conspiracy theorist is the word I'm looking for, but the phrase I'm looking for, rather. But I think that we've been looking at the wrong problems, or problems that were brought about on purpose to distract from what we actually need to be worried about. So, I mean, I'm not going to... Yeah, I think that's where I'm going to end on that note. But just as, like, I don't know. I just can't stop getting away from V for Vendetta. I keep thinking about that movie and how there were like problems that were brought about. You know, like a virus, the St. Mary's virus, I think they called it in the movie, and it was like a virus that was implemented by the government to cause a problem. And it's like, well, you know,
that's an extreme version.
It's an extreme version, but I think a lot of the things that people are focused on are the wrong things and aren't actually a very right. grave concern when they are blown out of proportion and shown to be.
Right, so like a quick example would be the incredible rate of heart disease and heart failure mm-hmm. as like a high-ranking cause of death.
Sure.
And just one stat from Diet for a Dead Planet by Christopher Cook is that there's 67% of American males overweight. So if obesity and the consequences of obesity are really that much of an issue, should we be like learning how to do better triple, quadruple bypass surgeries, or should we be like helping people live in a way that they won't need a triple, quadruple bypass surgery?
Mm-hmm. And I think it just goes in the type of technique that you're going to take against it. You know, are you going to go to war with the thing, which is, you know, I think that's, you know, doing the triple bypass. It's like, I can beat you versus like, I'm going to, you know, work with the mm-hmm. causes, I guess, you know.
Like learn from it.
Yeah, learn from it, exactly, and kind of be adaptive in a way, you know.
It seems to be like the American mentality that, like, when there's a problem, you just patch it up. And then when that breaks, you put another patch on top of that. So, like, going back to, like, the E. coli thing and the cattle, to fix that, what do they do to the cattle? They fill them full of antibiotics.
Yeah.
And then the bacteria gets stronger and stronger, and then you're eating the antibiotics.
Yeah. If you weren't with us earlier, we're talking about how cattle no longer graze on grass as their stomachs. All four of them were designed to do.
All four.
And now they're being fed these subsidized, genetically engineered grains such as corn. Mm-hmm. And this increases the population of E. coli in their stomachs. Yeah.
So like getting back to the patching, so you give the cattle antibiotics to kill the E. coli. Well, if some of them leak out, how do we prevent it from getting humans sick? Well, when they mix your meat with a meat filler for your burger, wherever you get it at, they bleach, cleanse the meat filler in ammonia or chlorine and then add it to the meat. And during its shipping phase, the chlorine or ammonia bath that it was given will leach into the meat and hopefully kill any remaining E. coli before it gets to your plate. Well, you can't tell me that once you cook that ammonia-soaked meat that you're not going to be ingesting any of that ammonia. You mm-hmm. can't. There's no way you'll get me to believe that soaking something in it to cleanse it won't eventually end up in your body.
Yeah, well, I think one of the things too about like going back to the vegetables, you know, getting like eating healthy, you know, mm-hmm. basically.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's the case that a lot of people don't want to eat healthy just because they're trained not to eat healthy. Mm-hmm. We've kind of been raised on like, man, sugar is awesome, and that's what I want.
It's
you know?
Fat, sugar, salt, and sugar.
Yeah.
That's the three things that are rare in nature. So,
and it's funny, naturally, our ancestors developed a really strong taste for these three things because they are so rare and so mm-hmm. crucial to our health. So fat isn't bad. Excess of fat is bad. Sugar mm-hmm. isn't bad. Excess of the wrong types of sugar is bad. Mm-hmm. But now our bodies crave it so much that they don't really understand the limits, and you just want three sodas a day because in nature you weren't able to get that sugar and you were like really programmed to like, oh, sweetness, we need more sweetness because it was good for you.
Mm-hmm. We almost need Dr. Sandstrom to explain us what's happening here.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And it's funny also, we talked about the methods we have for eating, and we sort of learned to eat poorly. We kind of talked about this when we talked about the ethics of alcohol and drinking. We talked about sort of teaching the youth to drink in a healthy environment, like an ecology where drinking isn't just occurring so that you can get blackout drunk, but it's maybe a social lubricant for dialogue, and you have one or two and call it good, and you sort of like pass on this like healthy way to enjoy alcohol. But instead of doing that, we have sort of the jump off a diving board, you're 21
right.
yeah.
approach.
It's a nice metaphor. I might use that in the future.
So education sounds like a key issue maybe.
I think education and also just like habit training. Right. I don't know, which I guess education ultimately is, you know, is a series of habits. I think, you know, the model of pouring, you know, information into the head, you know, rather than being like, here are some tools, you know, now we're going to make you work those tools so you know how to use them, come your own time, whatever, you know, and that seems more habitually based. But yeah, that was a tangent away from mm-hmm. where we were at.
And I think one cool thing that happens on campus is that campus dining truly does read those comment cards. I've gone to the campus dining department meetings when I was helping them develop composting procedures, and they often take, just one person's suggestion to have fruit water had every cafeteria, or excuse me, residential restaurant, having like water with pineapple in it or water with cranberries in it, like at in every residential restaurant now. They listen to the suggestion. So what you can do is go into your dining area, pick up that comment card and say, hey, let's get some non-genetically modified organisms in here. Let's get some local food in here. And like, these are really easy, almost effortless ways that you can participate and you can do something on a small scale right here on campus.
We actually have fruit water now, you're saying?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. I haven't been to a restaurant here in like 2 years, but good to know.
So for all you freshmen and sophomores out there, you're living the high life. We didn't have that good stuff.
I didn't know if we wanted to get back at all to, like, I know we were speaking about soda a moment ago. But I was looking at a quote here out of a book that some of you may be familiar with. It was made into a movie a few years ago. Not a very good movie, in my opinion, but Fast Food Nation by Eric Schlosser. He talks about soda as liquid candy, and found that in 1999, a study by the Center for Science and the Public Interest describes who is not benefiting from the beverage industry's latest marketing efforts, the nation's children. And it says here, in 1978, the typical teenage boy in the United States drank about 7 ounces of soda every day. Today, he drinks nearly 3 times the amount, driving 9% of his daily caloric intake from soft drinks. It says that soda consumption has doubled amongst teenage girls in the same period, reaching an average of 12 ounces a day. And a significant number of teenage boys are now drinking 5 or more cans of soda every day. And each can contains the equivalent of about 10 teaspoons of sugar. So imagine all that sugar that you're getting. Coke, Pepsi, Mountain Dew, Dr. Pepper also contain caffeine. And they provide empty calories and are replaced by have been replaced by the more nutritious beverages in the American diet. And the excessive soda consumption leads to later problems like calcium deficiency, bones being fractured because now they drink more soda than milk, for instance. So you're getting a lack of calcium.
Right, and bone density.
You know,
suffers.
It's just one of many examples showing health impact.
Isn't it not even sugar that's in the drinks? Isn't it high fructose corn?
Yeah, it's derived from the subsidized corn that we were talking about earlier.
And again, there's not any conclusive evidence that HFCS, as Josh and I call it back at home, high fructose corn syrup, that is actually like really a lot worse for you. But
you know, there's been a couple of things. I know a couple of years ago they found like higher levels than permitted of mercury in high fructose corn syrup. Because you got to kind of think of what's happening in all those pesticides. I mean, you're eating the subsidized corn that's GMO, but on top of that, what chemicals are carried along the process?
And which antibiotics?
You know, and I know that corn farmers had a commercial two years ago now, I think it was, that made people like myself and Chris, who spoke out against high fructose corn syrup, look like idiots. They had like a girl and a guy sitting in a park on a picnic blanket. And he wouldn't touch the popsicle. And she's like, well, you know, they say it's not bad for you. And then I think at the bottom of the screen it even says in moderation. It's like, okay, we know that. Like, go to the supermarket and see how many items in your cart have corn in them and then tell me if that's moderation.
Right.
Well, it's not. Because they put high fructose corn syrup in soda. They put it in bread. It's like, why does it have to
it's
be
kinda
in bread?
It's kind of everywhere. So if you're getting kind of depressed.
Why does it have to be in
why
bread?
Why does it have to be in bread?
If you're depressed about your bread.
Preservation and moisture, I think, is the reason they cite.
Yeah.
That's great.
But
so if you really are sad now about all of the horrible things in this food system, you're going to have to tune in with us next week on Sunday. We're going to talk more in depth about solutions, like practical action that you can take on a small scale and sort of start building healthier habits.
And I just wanted to sort of clear my conscience. I know I had spoke out about local, a little bit of local farming, like at Meyer. I mentioned the potatoes. But I guess the point of the show is just ask questions. Like, know, not only on food, but, like, everything. Like, know where your laws are coming from. Know, like, where your products are coming from. But most importantly, know where your food's coming from.
All right. This has been Ethics Talk. I'm talking about food. Thank you, Campus Grow, Chris and Josh. We appreciate your time so much. It was a great show.
Thank you.
We hope you'll join us next week for the sequel. We'll talk a little bit more about the RSO and what you can do to get involved. It's been a great day. Have a great afternoon.
You're listening to WMHW, HD1 and HD2 Mount Pleasant, Modern Rock 91.5. Where music begins.